This is a reading of a set of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Bees. Lecture 5, given in Dornach, December 10th, 1923. Some comments by people who were there first. Mr. Dollinger asks about honeycombs. There are people who eat the wax of the honeycomb along with the honey. Long ago, innkeepers sometimes used to put honeycombs on the table along with the food. He would like to know if there are any detrimental effects that might arise from eating the entire honeycomb. With regard to the diseases that can afflict bees, he thinks that these diseases were not as virulent as they are today, at a time when a larger quantity of honey is taken from the bees and artificial methods are used for feeding and breeding bees. Mr. Müller says that eating honeycombs is a matter of personal preference. Of course, they need to be of the completely natural type and not those that are artificially constructed. With regard to the diseases that afflict bees, he does not think they arise from modern methods used in working with bees and extracting larger amounts of honey. It is more likely that such diseases simply were not noted as carefully. Also, there were not as many hives with very small populations, so people did not pay as much attention to these things. There is one bee disease that came into Switzerland from England, a disease that had never been here before. Mr. Erbsmehl thinks that a possible cause might be the use of artificial chemical fertilizers. Flowers show the negative effects that they can cause. Dr. Steiner responds, with regard to both of the things you just mentioned, I might add another point. It's very true that eating the wax comb along with the honey is a type of predilection or penchant that some people have. With such things, it is naturally important to decide how well they can digest it. But that is a question that would have to be answered medically. It would be possible to say something meaningful about this question only if you could observe the people who eat both the honey and the wax comb, and then examine their health. I admit that I'm acquainted with various people who do this, but they usually spit out the wax portion after they have extracted the honey in their mouths. But not having observed people who have ingested larger quantities of wax along with the honey, I simply have nothing to report. There is one thing I suppose you could say. Human beings can tolerate and digest various things, and not everyone the same things. There may be people who, by ingesting beeswax, could develop an unpleasant stomach illness. They, of course, should be advised not to eat the wax. There may be others who have no problem digesting the wax and who pass the indigestible portions in the stool. In the case of the latter individuals, it would be possible to say that because they also ingest the wax, thereby leaving the honey in contact with the wax as long as possible, as it makes its way through the digestive tract, they digest the honey mainly in the intestines, whereas the honey otherwise, under normal conditions, continues being digested in the lymph ducts and so on after it has left the intestines. Well, you could say that this all depends on what state of health the individual is in. There are those who digest more in the intestinal region, and others who do it more in the lymph ducts. You won't be able to say simply that one method is good and the other bad. Everything must be adjusted to fit the individual human being. You could say something for certain only if you had one group of individuals eat honey with the comb and another honey without it, and then determine the relationship between these two groups. With reference to the diseases that afflict bees, for that matter, even diseases in general, you will need to consider what Mr. Müller has said. With humans also, it is true that people did not pay any attention at all to certain things, but now they study these things very carefully and pay careful attention to them. Another essential element also plays a role in this matter. Long ago, a beekeeper did many things based purely on instinct, without really knowing why. Today, humankind has lost these instincts, and everybody wants to know the reasons for every little thing. It's just for this reason that it's necessary to investigate every matter very thoroughly, and our present-day method of accumulating knowledge, scientifically, is usually not capable of doing such a thing. The beekeeper in the past had a very strong instinct to treat the bees in a very, if I may say so, personal and proper manner. Consider, for instance, the difference in providing housing for the bees. In earlier days, skeps were provided, but now it is boxes. These boxes are made of wood. Wood is a very different material from that which the quote-unquote basket beehives were made of, plaited straw or similar materials. In addition, this straw, by its nature, attracted from the air very different substances than wood does. So there we already see a difference in the way beekeepers externally treat bees. If I could summarize for you all the things a beekeeper did in the past, then I would say that there was a strong instinct for the way things were done. Sometimes the beekeeper did not know at all why they did things in a certain way, but they would select a place for the hives where the wind would reach them from this or that side, or something similar to that. Today these placements are made primarily from practical considerations, such as whether there is room enough for all the hives. Some thought is given to climatic conditions, but not as strongly as in former times. A comment now. Mr. Müller says that he still pays considerable attention to these things. He has his apiary on a ridge of hills where there is almost no north wind and not much east wind, and other considerations like that. Dr. Steiner responds, "Wood is less sensitive to such external elements compared with straw. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not a propagandist for the old-fashioned straw beehives, but these differences exist and also have a strong effect on things, such as the bee, when it accomplishes through inner work all the necessary chemical transformations. In the process of collecting nectar and converting it into honey, the bee carries out a tremendous task within its body. This is truly a gigantic task that the bee needs to complete. And how does it do this? It comes about because of the relationship between two types of juices in the bee, gastric and blood. If you examine the contents of a bee, you'll see the white gastric juice and the somewhat reddish blood juice. These are the two essential components that make up a bee. All the other parts arise out of the effects created by these two juices. What's really important is that there is a very specific relationship between the gastric juice and the blood juice. There is a significant difference between them. The gastric juice is sour. It is what chemists call acetous. A-C-E-T-O-U-S. The blood juice is what chemists call alkaline, which means that it is not acetous, nor is it an acid, but it can only be acidified. If the gastric juice doesn't have sufficient acid content, then a process takes place within the bee, a process that disturbs its inner organism as honey is being made. The blood juice is strengthened only when the corresponding and very necessary conditions of climate, light, warmth, and so forth are present. If you want to gain control over such bee diseases as those that have appeared recently, it will depend in large part on bringing about the appropriate effect by regulating and attaining the properly balanced relationship between the bee's gastric and blood juices. And because beekeeping is no longer conducted on such a simple basis as it once was long ago, you won't be able to effect a change through climatic and warmth conditions, since they don't affect the newer beehives. All that is left, then, is to do research to determine what might be the greatest effect on the bee's blood juice. And probably future beekeepers will always need to monitor their bees and make certain that the suitable preparation for the bees' blood juices is constantly taking place. In order to do this, it is important to keep the following point in mind. It is true, isn't it, that there are years when bees are forced to collect almost all their honey nectar from trees. Footnote: what is meant is from the sugary excretions, honeydew of the aphids, See also note page 66. End of footnote. During such years, the constitution of the bee's blood is in extreme danger. They contract diseases more easily than in other years. For such a situation, it will be important for future beekeepers to set up a very small greenhouse, it doesn't have to be very large, in which the beekeeper will keep and tend artificially such plants that bees love at certain times of the year, plants that bees definitely need. In this way, the beekeeper will have a small bed of flowers toward which he can send his bees, for instance, in May. The bees will seek them out by instinct when those specific plants that they need are either doing very poorly in nature or are not even present during such a period in May. In this way, by helping nature through placing a small nursery garden in the vicinity of the beehive, you will be able to gain control over such diseases in the future. I would recommend such methods, but they are only suggestions. I do believe they will be worthwhile, since they come from knowledge about the nature of bees. A beekeeper will see good results if these methods are employed. This is the way to fight these diseases. But you'll have to take into account all the relationships that exist in order to proceed in a practical manner. This is not just my opinion, but rather the result of studying the nature of bees. Someone ought to try to set up an experiment with greenhouse plants that thrive at a certain time of year when in nature they are withering or dying off, and probably the bee's health will be improved. I am convinced such effects will come to light when researchers once again investigate these matters with a true cognizance of nature. Today it can no longer be a question of turning back the clock of history. Just as we don't need to be reactionaries in political life, likewise we don't have to be reactionaries in specialized areas. We need to go along with progress. What is important is to pay attention to what we do as we're leaving the old behind, to bring about a balance by means of something else that returns and gives back to us what we've lost. That's what I have to say about this matter. Next comment. Mr. Müller states that beekeepers are already working toward providing such artificial plantings dedicated to the purpose just discussed. For example, some have planted yellow crocuses and other similar plants with small yellow blossoms in order to make these flowers available to the bees. Many have even planted American clover, which can grow as high as 2 meters and has blossoms all year long. The farmers wait until fall to harvest it, but before the harvest it is available to the bees. That's what would be necessary. Dr. Steiner responds, "Yes, they're starting to do these things, but they understand too little about the actual relationships involved. The point that you mentioned first is a good step in the right direction, a direction that should be continued. That which you mentioned about American clover with its perpetual blossoming is something that will eventually be abandoned because it doesn't improve the bee's blood juice. What American clover does is stimulate the bees for a short time, just as you might stimulate a human being with alcohol. The bees get all worked up and are able to work harder for a time, but one thing you should watch very carefully. Don't introduce something completely foreign to the bees, since bees, according to their inner nature, have become accustomed to and are tied to a specific area or region. You can see this by noting the variations in the appearance of bees that come from different regions. There is the Middle European bee, the common house bee already mentioned. The Italian bee has a very different appearance. The Carniolan bee, Carniolan, is very different from the Italian bee. Bees are very strongly attached to the region they belong to, and as a result you won't be able to impart any long-term benefit by giving them nectar derived from regions foreign to them. If you do this, they will need to expend extra energy in converting the nectar within their bodies, where they will experience turmoil as they attempt to convert the nectar into a form like the form it takes in the place the clover came from. For a few years you might be successful, but there will be real trouble later on. You correctly said that we still don't have enough data to make any meaningful statement about this situation, but time will tell, and beekeepers will stop doing it, or they will do what wine growers once did. The experience of the wine growers was this. You probably know that in the 1870s and 1880s, the vine louse, Phylloxera, suddenly appeared and devastated the vines over large areas of Europe. At that time, I was able to occupy myself very thoroughly with this problem, because I had as a good friend a farmer who published an agricultural newspaper and devoted much space to this specific problem. Footnote: most probably this was Hugo Hitchmann, 1838 to 1904, founder of modern newspapers on forestry and agriculture in Austria. He co-founded governmental organizations on forestry and agriculture, and after 1870 owned the Viennese agricultural newspaper. In 1883 he established the Austrian forestry and hunting newspaper, in 1884 the general wine newspaper, in 1867 the practical farmer, and in 1878 the economist. Beginning in 1879, he also published a farmer's pocket calendar, and beginning in 1882, Archive for Farming Matters and A Handbook for the Farmer. End of footnote. There were people who were contemplating why it was that American grapevines had no lice and were not endangered. What came of all this? They discovered that the means used to battle lice on American vines wouldn't work when applied to European vines. The result was that when they began planting the American vines, they were successful in keeping the American vines healthy, but the European ones still died. Then they were forced to give up the European vines entirely and Americanize the entire process of growing grapes. Thus, viticulture became entirely transformed and evolved into something very different from what it once was. In many regions, it has become something very distinct in many ways. You can't think so mechanically about it, but you should be clear in your minds that things, by their very nature, are tied to certain localities, because they have become accustomed to them. This must be taken into consideration. Otherwise, you can probably achieve momentary successes, but not anything lasting. Is there anything else you would like to ask, or are all the silent gentlemen interested only in eating honey, but not in engaging in much discussion about it? Perhaps one or the other of you will think of something that you could ask. I would still like to revisit the matter concerning the true nature of the bee's ability to create honey and fill in a few more details. Basically, it is truly a wonderful thing that such small creatures exist that are capable of extracting from blossoms, flowers, and plants that substance which they transform into this extraordinarily healthy honey, a substance that could play a more important role in human nutrition than it does today. All that is necessary is that people gain a thorough insight into how terribly important honey is as a food. For example, if it were possible to exert more of an influence on the entire field of what I might call social medicine, I would consider it an extremely favorable influence if couples, during the time of their engagement, would eat honey as a preparatory activity before having children. For in this way they would not have rickety children, because there is in honey a force that can affect the reproductive power in human beings, who then in turn transform this honey power further, so as to give the offspring a proper bodily form. The parents, more specifically the mothers, consumption of honey has a beneficial effect that extends itself to the bony skeletal frame of the child. Such influences will be discovered once people investigate the deeper connections between these things. Rather than all these useless details and vagaries that you can encounter printed in scientific journals today, you'll find at some point in the future, when they know something about these matters, such questions as, quote, which foods are considered good nutrition at such and such a time in life, and which are good another time in life, unquote, and so on. Yes, that will be of tremendous use to people, because their condition of health will be vastly improved as a result of it. More particularly, their level of energy will increase. The one thing you can say is that people generally do not attach very much value to these facts, because a person who doesn't have rickety children may, to be sure, be very happy about it, but would not really think about it very much. It is accepted as a matter of course, without much attention being paid to it. The only person who complains is the one who has rickety children. Hence I would like to say that those very medical, social regulations that are the most useful have to wait the longest before becoming reality, because they are trying to establish what people should consider to be normal conditions. But in order to understand that it is possible to bring about a great positive effect in this direction, I do believe that if general public interest in this matter were to arise through following the ideas and methods indicated by anthroposophic science, then those people who searched for the spiritual element in the proper sense would come upon these insights by themselves. Much more is necessary than what is being done now, when people are advised in this way, quote, "You should pray, because by praying this or that will happen," unquote. You'll be able to gain insight and reach a conclusion only by applying the powers of mind, intellect, soul, heart, spirit, and imagination. This is what, quote, "looking at something spiritual," unquote, really means. Yes, gentlemen, these things can be properly ascertained only in this way. Modern science is not acquainted with such an all-encompassing viewpoint. These are simple matters that you can gain knowledge about, as, for instance, at which particular time, let's say at the time of a couple's engagement, honey can be most useful. As I've just indicated, it is truly something to marvel at how the bee sucks the honey nectar commonly available in nature, transforms it within itself, and produces honey, which is so extraordinarily useful for human life. You'll begin to understand how honey originates if I tell you about the same process in a completely different form, as it is found in the neighbors or relatives of the bees. You'll begin to understand how honey originates if I tell you about the same process in a completely different form, as it is found in the neighbors or relatives of the bees, the wasps. However, from wasps you can't get anything similar to honey that would be beneficial to mankind, although medicine has found a way to make great use of another product that wasps produce. But the way wasps work is quite different from that of bees. Next time I'll also tell you about ants, but let's first examine a specific type of wasp. Cynipidae, I don't know how to pronounce that, C-Y-N-I-P-I-D-A-E. There are wasps that have the unusual trait of laying their eggs just about anywhere, in plants, in trees, and, for example, in leaves or the bark of trees. There are even some that lay them in the blossoms of trees. It would look like this, Table 8, page 165, upper middle. There is a branch, and there, let's say, an oak leaf. The wasp, using its ovipositor, a stinger that is hollow inside, deposits its egg on the oak leaf. What happens now? The entire leaf tissue surrounding the spot where the wasp egg was placed undergoes a complete transformation. The leaf would have grown very differently if the egg had not been placed there. Let's now look at what arises at this spot. Here the growth of the plant has been changed completely, and around the wasp egg, sticking out of the leaf, a gall is formed. These galls are brownish in appearance, but how do they arise? They arise from the changed plant substance that now surrounds the wasp egg. Normally this wasp egg would not thrive if it were placed just anywhere. It can thrive only if this protective substance, which the wasp steals from the plant, is present. The bee places its egg into the comb, and the egg becomes a larva, the larva a pupa, and finally the pupa a bee, which goes out to steal a plant substance and convert it within itself to something else. The wasp also does this, but somewhat earlier than the bee. The wasp, by placing the egg into the plant, takes the substance it needs from the plant at that time. The bee, however, waits somewhat longer than the wasp before it begins using the plant substance. With higher animals and humans, the egg already has a protective covering in the mother's body, that which the mother herself produces to protect the egg, the wasp needs to take from the plant in this instance. The gall is produced by the plant around the egg in the same way that in humans the placenta, which is expelled at birth, protects the growing embryo and fetus within the mother. You notice how the wasp comes together with the plant. In areas where many such wasps live, you will observe that the trees are covered completely with such galls. This type of wasp and this type of tree have a symbiotic relationship. The wasp is dependent on the tree and would not be able to procreate without having the plant create the protective shell around the egg. These galls can take on different appearances. Some don't look like apples, but rather like hair that has become entangled. Footnote: these are the rose galls of the rose gall wasp, Rhoditis rosae. End of footnote. But everywhere you will find, in the center, the wasp egg. Sometimes these galls take the form of small, shaggy nuts. Table 8, right. This demonstrates how wasps live together with plants. Then, when the wasp has matured sufficiently, it drills its way out using its mandibles to live as an adult, until it, repeating the cycle, places its egg into another leaf. The placement of eggs always involves a symbiotic relationship with plants. Now, you could perhaps ask, what does this have to do with the preparation of honey? Gentlemen, it has a lot to do with it, and you can learn how honey is created if you consider this matter. Once again, you'll find that in folk wisdom, in the instinctive agricultural knowledge that has been passed down generation by generation, just such a thing is taken into account. You perhaps know that in the southern regions, Greece, to be specific, figs play an important role. There are so-called wild figs, which are somewhat sweet, but not sweet enough for some people with a sweet tooth. So, what do these people do to bring about even sweeter figs? Imagine that this represents a wild fig tree. This wild fig tree is very attractive to a particular type of wasp, which places its eggs into the fig. Imagine that this is the wild fig tree, with a fig growing on the branch, and that this fig contains the egg the wasp has laid. Table 8, left. The fig grower is really a rather smart person. The grower allows the wasps to lay their eggs in the wild fig trees. Afterward, two such figs are taken down at a particular point in time when the wasp larvae have not finished developing and still have a long way to go before they would normally emerge. In any case, they have finished a portion of their development. What happens now? The fig grower takes a stalk of rush and ties together these two figs containing the undeveloped wasp larvae in such a way that they'll hold together. Now this person goes to another fig tree, which has figs that need to be improved, and hangs on that tree the figs tied together because they contain the eggs that the wasp deposited there. Table 8, middle. What happens now? This is what happens. The wasps notice the change, because the figs, torn off the first tree, begin drying up, since they're no longer directly attached to the fig tree. The figs dry up, because they don't receive any more sap from the tree. Naturally, the not yet fully developed wasp senses inwardly what is happening. Even the undeveloped egg can sense this. The result is that the wasp speeds up tremendously the time of its emergence. For this reason, the grower begins this procedure in spring. First, the wasp is allowed to lay its eggs. Suddenly, toward the month of May, the two figs are taken down to go through this transfer procedure. Oh my, the insect inside the fig thinks. Now I must really hurry. It is already time for the fig to begin drying out. The animal greatly accelerates its inner processes, and it emerges much earlier than it normally would. Had the fig remained attached to the tree, the wasp would have come out at the end of the summer, but now it has to emerge in early summer. As a result of coming out this early, it is forced into creating a second brood. It lays a second set of eggs during the summer, while it normally would have waited until the following spring to do so. To lay this second set of eggs, the wasp goes over to the other figs growing on the same tree, the ones that the grower hopes to improve. It places its eggs into them, eggs that don't achieve maturity and develop only to a certain degree. What happens as a result? The figs containing the second brood become twice as sweet as the other wild figs. This is what is called the enrichment or improvement of figs, because they become twice as sweet. What has happened here? The wasps, although related to bees, are in comparison very different, because in the form of an egg they have already taken from the plant what potentially can become honey. If you, in such a clever fashion as the fig grower, were to tie together, using a stalk of rush, two of your wild figs containing wasp eggs, and swing them up into the tree so that they hang up there, and if, in this way, you cause them to once again weave into the plant what they have absorbed from another plant, then you would be able to cause the wasp to inject this honey as a form of added sweetness into these now improved figs. The wasp injects this extra sweetness into the improved figs by thinly distributing the honey within them. This happens in a roundabout way that nature provides. You can see that we have not taken anything out of nature, but rather have allowed the true nature of honey to remain what it really is. A wasp is unable to prepare honey the same way that a bee does. The organization of this insect isn't even suited for that. But if you force the wasp to take this detour, it can transfer during its reproductive cycle to one plant the sweetness of the honey it has extracted from another plant. It thus makes this second improved fig sweet, and you'll find in it a kind of honey-like substance. With this example, we have come upon something very noteworthy. It becomes evident that these wasps have a body incapable of extracting from nature a nectar-like substance and converting it within themselves into honey. But using natural processes, they can make possible a certain type of honey creation involving the transfer of something from one fig to another. The bee is a creature that has developed its wasp-like body to such an extent that it can carry on independently, away from the tree, the process that the wasp can carry on only in the tree itself. We need to realize that the bee is an insect that maintains within itself the power that the wasp has only as long as it is very young, that is, in the egg, larva, or pupa stage. The wasp loses the power to produce honey after it matures, but the bee maintains it even as an adult. Just consider, gentlemen, what it means when a person can look out into all of nature and say that in plants you can find honey, this substance that tends toward being a sugary, sweet substance. It's just simply in there somehow. But you can make it appear, if only you follow the right paths. And you can do so by lending support to already existing natural processes, such as causing the wasp to move at the proper time to another tree, the fruits of which you wish to make sweeter. Up here in our area, you can't do things such as this anymore, especially now in our present day and age. These things are no longer possible to achieve. But there once was a time in the development of the earth when there was the possibility of taking wasps, as we still do today and others did even 2,000 years ago, and using them in such a way as the clever wild fig grower does. By forcing a second brood in the same year, and allowing them to emerge prematurely, the possibility existed for allowing wasps to emerge and to deposit their eggs into the mature figs that had already been picked. By doing this, little by little, for a long time, growers once succeeded in breeding wasps into bees. A bee is an animal that was bred from wasps a very long time ago. Today you can still see in animal activity, in the activity of wasps specifically, how the preparation or creation of honey existed in nature itself before the existence of bees. And from this example, you can also determine what the facts may be about bees putting their honey into combs in a very definite manner. The comb consists mainly of a wax substance. Note also that this wax substance isn't necessary just as a place for the honey to be deposited. It is necessary for the bee to secrete the wax. But it's also the case that a bee can prepare honey only if its whole body is functioning properly. The second fig tree, in which the sweetness arises by itself, also has a richer wax content than the original wild fig tree. This increased wax content is one of the most important differences between the improved fig tree and the wild one. Nature, all by itself, creates this additional wax. It is this improved, sweetened fig, growing and thriving on a tree, that makes itself to a certain degree waxier than it was before. Here you can find the primitive prototype that prefigures what is later found in bee culture. If you want to examine these facts in greater detail, you can take a cut through a stem from the improved tree, and what you'll find, strangely enough, when you look carefully, are markings that look like wax cells. Table 8, lower right. Out of the wax that accumulates inside the stem, growths such as these, specifically a type of bee cell, begin to form. The improved fig becomes richer in wax content, and inside the stem the wax originates it, and inside the stem the wax organizes itself into something resembling a cell form. You may come to the following conclusion. If we examine this process for improving figs, what we have is a natural but primitive method for producing honey, the only difference being that the honey remains within the fig. The bee places, if I may express it this way, before the public eye that which remains hidden within nature in the case of the improved fig. With the help of the wasp, nature is able to do the same in this way. The wax is pushed up into the fig, the wax that would otherwise have remained in the stem and created cells through natural formation. Cells that are not massive or very obvious, but are simply hinted at and disappear again quickly. In this way, the entire wax and honey formation is located in the fig. This entire bee culture is located within the tree, so that we can truly say that nature generally is a beekeeper. What does a bee do first? A bee lays an egg into the comb, and the egg matures. Now, it doesn't need to transform a substance into a gall nut, but simply takes the nectar directly from the plant. It doesn't have to go to another tree that has a greater wax content, but instead creates from itself that which otherwise is formed in the stem, the comb structure, and puts juice into it, now known as honey, whereas this juice is distributed throughout the entire fig, in the case of the improved fig. You could also say that with bees, a process that nature normally restricts to the realm of the tree alone is carried out openly, in public view, and then only with the cooperative effort of both the tree and the wasp. Now you should be able to see clearly what you have before you, when you look at an artistically created honeycomb with its regularly constructed wax cells. It's really a marvelous thing to look at, isn't it, Mr. Mueller? And to top it all, there is honey in the cells. Yes, gentlemen, just look at this. Then you'll say that it is amazing that the bee seems to represent, in the construction of its wonderful comb cells made of wax, something that resembles an artistically constructed tree trunk with all its ramifications. The bee doesn't go into a tree to lay its eggs, but instead builds for itself that which resembles a picture of a tree. And rather than first letting the figs grow on the tree, it places the honey into the honeycomb already prepared for it. Thus we have created with the bee, in this case, a copy of the process we saw in the artificially sweetened wild fig tree. This has been an actual view into the innermost workings of nature. This example can show you what it is that you can learn directly from nature. You simply have to become acquainted with what is really out there in nature. Human beings still have much to learn about nature, but first they must find and see in operation the spirit element at work. Only then will they learn such things. Otherwise, you will, like all the rest, stand there gaping when you travel south and observe the clever person who ties together reed stalks that have holes pricked into them and swings them up into a wild fig tree. You will stand there open-mouthed like the other travelers, even some scientists among them, who do not know why this person does such a thing. This person has preempted the work that bees normally do. The grower does this by allowing nature to put honey into the figs. And these figs in the region where they thrive are in a similar way as healthy as honey, because a primitive form of honey is present in them, as provided directly by nature, without the help of bees. These are things you should call to mind when you wish to discuss anything as important and as penetrating to the mind as beekeeping. I believe that with this information you will gradually be able to move toward acquiring a somewhat more correct way of looking at these matters. There's a question and answer period. R. Hahn asks, after the lecture I approached Dr. Steiner and asked, what is the cause of a foul brood? Footnote, foul brood refers to a destructive disease of honeybee larvae caused by a bacteria. End of footnote. He commented that he would be able to say something definite about this only after he had really done some research regarding this disease. But probably a queen bee's foul brood had something to do with its defective composition of uric acid. He then said, quote, it's true, isn't it, that a bee also has uric acid in its system, so the probable cause of this disease is the imperfect compounding of uric acid, unquote. Regarding the breeding of wasps into bees, as mentioned in the same lecture, he responded approximately as follows to a related query, quote, this process took place during the Atlantean Age on the old continent of Atlantis, at a time when the individual animal forms were not yet as fixed as they are today, and when the boundaries between the various families and genera were not yet as rigidly established as they are now. Today such a far-ranging cross-breeding would not be possible anymore. The end of Lecture 5.